This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, we're going to listen back to a conversation we had earlier this year with Dr. Terry Root. She's a senior fellow emerita in the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University, and she was a lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change Fifth Assessment Report that in 2007 was co-awarded the Nobel Peace Prize with Vice President Al Gore. She was in town to give a presentation about the many ways that plastics in the environment are harming wildlife. But first, we've been hearing more and more stories lately about the various places plastics are showing up in our environment. Stories of dead dolphins washing ashore on local beaches with pounds of plastic in their stomachs. Scientists breaking deep sea diving records only to find a plastic bag and food wrappers. Researchers have even found microplastics in remote areas of the Pyrenees Mountains. A recent NPR story says researchers at Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute have found microplastics throughout the water column. And now new research out of the University of Victoria in British Columbia suggests that annual microplastics consumption here in the U.S. ranges from 39,000 to 52,000 particles, depending upon age and sex. And people who mostly drink bottled water may be ingesting an additional 90,000 microplastic particles annually, compared to a mere 4,000 for those who consume only tap water. We're revisiting a conversation about these startling numbers with that study's lead researcher. Kieran Cox is a marine biology PhD candidate and Hackeye scholar at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He joined us via Skype. Let's hear that now. Kieran, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thank you for your time.
No problem at all. Thank you very much for having me.
And we do invite you to join our conversation. To do so, you can give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Kieran, what got you started on this study?
Well, I mean, I think it's something that's really easy to connect to personally. You know, I've been working in the marine environment for quite some time, and plastics have become a big topic there. But, you know, you want to connect to it personally, and you start thinking about the different places that plastics are ending up, and it's quite evident that our food sources are a major part of that. You know, a lot of our connection to the marine environment is consumption-based. So that was definitely my first initial introduction to it. But then ultimately, I also found the lack of context really hard to navigate. And I know that personally, if I'm a scientist and I can't kind of understand what one study means relative to another, it's highly likely the general public can't as well. So I set out with the objective of pulling all the literature possible on any item that could be destined for human consumption, its plastic concentration, and the resulting consumption by people. Really to give people that full picture, you know, okay, what's your annual consumption likely to be? What don't we know? What are some items of major concern? And where do we need to go from here? So that was my motivation.
Did you begin with any sort of hypothesis as to what you would find in terms of these numbers? And if so, how did that stack up with where you wound up?
Yeah, we did. We kind of, you know, I was hoping it would probably be less, you know, and I was hoping, the one thing I was hoping was that there'd be more data on certain areas. You know, this has been a topic within the media and within research for quite a while, but one of the things we definitely found that we hoped would not be the case is these major data gaps. And so we essentially have no information on, you know, the plastic in poultry or beef or dairy, a lot of our, you know, let's say terrestrial-based or land-based food systems. But we know these industries are associated with a lot of plastic through, you know, production, assembly lines, and then on into packaging. And there really just hasn't been any work there. So to me, that was too bad, because to give people, you know, the appropriate context to navigate their exposure to plastic, you really need that data. So I kind of hoped that would have come out while we were doing the work, but unfortunately it didn't. But hopefully it's one of the areas that people will focus now moving forwards, because we have these kind of numbers and we know where we're limited, right? So we were able to get to about 15% of your caloric intake. So, you know, if you consider something like a food guide or the food pyramid, that's a very small piece of that puzzle. And I hope, you know, there'll continue to be innovative research to fill in the rest of it.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Kieran Cox. He's a marine biology PhD candidate at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. We're discussing some research that he's the lead author of that was published in the American Chemical Society's journal Environmental Science and Technology about human consumption of microplastics. So 15% of caloric intake, do those numbers that I mentioned during the intro represent just that 15%, or is that then scaled up based on, you know, sort of extrapolating from that?
No, that is just that 15%. Okay. So that is what we can consider a underestimate. And we can do that because when we took all the items, so these were, you know, salt, sugars, honeys, seafood, water, which is, you know, not obviously caloric in its value. And then when we took that, we got to about 50,000 microplastics for someone like me as an adult male. It's a little bit less if, you know, you're, say, an adolescent female. But that's only a really small piece of the puzzle. So very conservative estimate right now, not accounting for, again, the items I've previously mentioned, but then also items that aren't recommended. So if you think about something like the middle of the grocery store, a lot of those aisles are associated with large amount of plastic. And there's been, you know, really no work done on those topics. So very conservative estimates at this point, likely underestimates.
Define microplastic in the context of this study for our listeners.
Mm-hmm. So microplastic is generally thought of as a piece of plastic that's less than 5 millimeters. And then that size range goes down quite a bit. The thing that I would say for most listeners is a lot of the plastics that we're talking about are much smaller than 5 millimeters. So to give you context, 5 millimeters is about the size of a grain of rice or a sesame seed, something of this nature. But a lot of the plastics that we're looking at are much smaller than that. So they're not going to be things you're going to see with the naked eye. And that's why, you know, you're inhaling so many of them and they're in your drinking water and you're not aware of them. And they're able to get into our food this way. So a very, very small piece of plastic, basically, that's moving through our environment. And they can get there in a few ways. So there's these plastics that are created small. So these are things like, you know, the microbead or the nurdle that people have kind of rallied around trying to remove from systems. And then there's also plastics as they break down and they shed. And so this would be something that, like, you know, a really, you know, top quality jacket that's made of a synthetic material shedding these microfibers, or larger pieces of plastic in the environment are shedding microplastics as well.
Can you give us a real quick sort of sense of the scope of these studies that you took your data from, and maybe also the age of them? Were they all fairly contemporary?
Yeah, this is really a new school of thought. So definitely all within the last 10 years, the research field itself has gone out through these waves of innovation, as, you know, incredibly talented researchers have figured out different ways to look at plastics under scopes or ID them, you know, identify them down. So there's a lot of chemical work that's being done now. So people can say, okay, we found this plastic and we identified it to come from this source. So they're all fairly new in their nature, just based on where the field is. There has been a lot of innovation. And with that, there's been some methods that are, say, less common now. But, you know, our goal was to be very conservative and be able to say things very safely, because the last thing we want is to cause any sort of, you know, unnecessary panic. So we always erred on the side of caution when presenting the values. And if in some cases, we even modified the numbers according to the methods they used. Let's say they, you know, detected a small portion that were plastic and a portion that were something else, we would just exclude that portion from the data so we could say, you know, with confidence that our 50,000 or 100,000 estimate, whatever it ended up being, was exactly that.
And then also, you know, your abstract says that if you also factor in that the air we breathe, it puts those numbers way up. Can you talk just a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one I personally did not see coming. But it seems to be the case that there's a large amount of microplastics in the air. Now, these are predominantly microfibers, and as a result, they're quite light and they can become airborne. And so when we factored in respiration, we actually figured out that, yeah, that number you mentioned of 50,000 for someone like me, who, you know, I breathe quite a bit, I'm going to potentially, you know, be consuming up to 120,000 microplastics annually. And this data is also reflected well within consumption literature. There was a really great study that showed that if you're preparing food in your apartment, you might actually be accumulating more plastics during the preparation and setting your food on the table than actually showed up in the food initially. So that's a really interesting finding, just basically pointing out that airborne plastics are, you know, maybe the major source, but definitely one of the top sources for plastic entering our system.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Kieran Cox. He's a marine biology PhD candidate at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. We're discussing new research that shows humans are unknowingly consuming a whole lot of microplastics. Kieran is lead author of the study, which was recently published in the American Chemical Society's journal Environmental Science and Technology. If you'd like to ask him a question, please give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or you can find us on Facebook. Facebook at WGCU Public Media and ask a question there, or on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So I'm no expert, but I was really shocked to find that all of these different food items have microplastics in them. I mean, how difficult is it to find them if you were to look closely? I mean, are the smaller ones not visible to the naked eye? They would take some sort of a microscope to find them or see them?
Mm-hmm, most certainly. So the general process is collect the item that you would like to investigate. Obviously, this has to be very clean and controlled process. As we know, microplastics are in the air. So a lot of this work is happening in clean rooms or bare minimum, kind of a fume hood with a very controlled environment. Obviously, samples are run to make sure that you didn't accidentally contaminate what you were working on. So it's quite a labor-intensive process. You need to figure out a way to basically digest down the material. So let's say it's something like honey and it has potentially plastic in it. You need to figure out a way to digest down that honey so that you can then filter it onto a very basically like small poured screen. It's then going under a compound scope or some sort of scope. There's been a lot of innovation in that part of the detection. And then you're counting the plastics. You might be using chemical identification of the plastics to confirm that they are plastics. So it's been quite an innovative process. And it's one of the reasons why we decided to undertake this project in the literature. You can think about all the different items we looked at. You know, this represents a decade of innovation in terms of figuring out how to digest down salts and sugars and honeys and seafoods and, you know, even filtering air appropriately. So quite a labor-intense process. So definitely, you know, my hat's off to the field in general who's been doing all this work over years. So yeah, they are quite small to see, and it does take quite a bit of time to get through a sample in, you know, the appropriate way. But you're right, a lot of these items do have plastic. I would personally think that it's the case that, you know, it'd probably be more uncommon to find no plastic in an item than plastic in an item at this point. At least that's what the data is suggesting. You know, you mentioned it in the start of your show. We're talking isolated mountain lakes, sea ice, the deepest parts of the ocean. You know, really our over-reliance and overproduction of plastic, especially plastic that we're using quite quickly. So these would be things like single-use plastics, have just resulted in this really being integrated into all aspects of our life and all aspects of the ecosystem, you know, and that's kind of self-evident. If I look around the room I'm in right now, I'll be able to count no less than a dozen types of plastic. And so I think that really just speaks to the fact that, you know, obviously it's going to end up in the foods we're eating.
You know, I referenced at the beginning of the show, there was a story over the weekend that NPR ran about research at Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, and they tested water throughout the water column, and there's these small filter feeding organisms. I can't remember the name of them, but they're kind of pervasive throughout the system. And they said 100% of these tiny organisms had microplastics in them. And it seems to me like you can't not just extrapolate that out to the whole world, right? I mean, it seems like if it's in one place, it's probably pretty endemic everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially with airborne plastics, you know, you're talking about plastics moving these far distances. And again, there's been a lot of plastic production to date. So it's an extremely pervasive problem. And it's just getting worse. So I think you're completely right. I mean, you always want to still go about it in a very, you know, scientific manner. We do want to say, okay, well, you know, what about this system and what about that system? And for me personally, I think context is really important here. Especially if you want the general public to kind of be able to sort through this information, you want to say, okay, if plastics are ubiquitous, well, where are they most pervasive and where are they having the most impact and what areas should we focus on? If not, you risk just creating a problem that is almost too big for people to understand personally. And then, you know, they don't know where to start. So I think context is always really important.
You know, one of the things that's come up on this show before is the amount of, sea salt that we would buy at the grocery store pretty much all has at least a little bit of microplastic in it. And I found that to be something, like you were just saying, that people can really connect to, because a lot of them have sea salt on their shelf at home that they bought at the local grocery store. And if you melt that down into water, there's tiny bits of plastic in the bottom.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I mean, now we know that there's plastic in the water you're putting it into, and depending on the source of the water, you're going to find vast differences in the number of plastics in that system. So again, it's really pervasive. I think what you want to do as we move forwards in this is allow people to understand, okay, well, is there more plastic in this salt versus this salt? And you know, the big question for me is, are there companies that are taking this seriously to the point that they're trying to mitigate these potential exposures for people? And if so, can we support those kind of companies as we move forwards? Because if this is ubiquitous, you know, we can't just say, well, you know, let's move over here, move over there. It's everywhere. So let's kind of work through it together and try to support companies that are doing their best and you know, kind of motivate those that have somewhere to go.
Let's talk a little bit about bottled water, because, you know, your study seems to indicate that bottled water is a huge source of microplastics. Is that because they're putting water into the bottle that has plastic in it, or the bottle itself is putting plastic into the water?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is an interesting one because, you know, because we did a literature review, this data has been out there for a while. I think it was just us summarizing it and looking really across quite a few studies that really made it self-evident to people. So, but as for where the plastics are coming from, it's a really interesting issue. And there's some great work done by Chelsea Rockman and a large collaboration at the University of Toronto that kind of highlighted this idea that not all plastics are the same, and we kind of are speaking to them as if they're almost one group, right? And so it's really important to think about specific plastics and their specific role in an environment and what they're doing. And I think there's a similar concept is true for when you're talking about contamination, where, you know, it might be coming from the bottle, it might be coming from the assembly line, it might be coming from the water going into it, it might be settling out of the environment. There's just so many different routes. You know, it could be to do with how long these things are sitting on the shelves or the temperature. There's just so many different theories have been proposed. And I think the best way forwards is to start testing and start really thinking about this because, you know, there are, you know, dozens and hundreds of places in the world. I mean, the reality is there's thousands of places in the world that still rely on bottled water for their clean water. And so I think you do need access to clean drinking water. And so I don't think we can just negate the role of bottled water in society altogether. But we do need to move forwards in trying to understand how the plastics are getting there. You know, what are the major mechanisms? What are the major types of plastic? And I think the field is really, you know, in a good place to do this because we can identify specific plastics. And so they could, you know, really determine if they're coming from the assembly line or it's the bottle themselves. There's a lot of good techniques that can be used to figure this out. But yes, you're very much correct. We did identify that, you know, if you take something like all of your water intake from tap water versus all of your water intake from bottled water. So for an adult male like me, that's about 3 liters a day. The difference is about a 22-fold increase in microplastics annually. So with tap water, I'd be consuming about 5,000 plastics. With bottled water, on average, it would be about 130,000 plastics, 120,000 plastics. So that's a very severe increase just in terms of magnitude. And the question really is, okay, what does that mean? Is there any way to mitigate it? You know, if you need to drink bottled water, then I would definitely recommend that you don't switch off bottled water if you have, you know, poor quality tap water. But a lot of people in, you know, North America, especially, we have the ability to choose where our water comes from. We're incredibly fortunate that way. And so, you know, hopefully people start to think a little bit more carefully about, you know, what they're putting in their bodies, basically.
You know, I you're probably not an expert on filtration technology, but do you have any sense of whether how we can filter water can get small enough to take out the tiniest versions of these microplastics?
This is a big topic, and it's a big topic for many reasons. So one of the ways, if not the most common way, that plastic is entering marine environments, maybe not the most common, but let's say one of the top ways, I can say that safely. One of the top ways that plastic is entering marine environments is through things like our sewer system, right? So if you wash your clothes, you're releasing a huge number of microfibers. In some cases, these aren't being treated effectively and they're entering the marine environment. And so it's really a two-way scenario, right? Where we're going to start thinking hopefully more carefully about filtering water that we're drinking, but we also need to think about filtering systems that we're letting out into the marine environment. So I think currently one of the big concerns facing this is the size of these plastics, right? We know that microplastics range quite a bit in size, and we haven't really even broached the topic of nanoplastics, which are going to be just the next step down from microplastics. And so I think there's a lot of concern about, can we filter water to this point? If so, what else are we filtering out? How costly is it going to be? You know, you think about something like the plastic in seawater. Well, it becomes really difficult to filter seawater if you also have to remove all the life that lives in that water, right? So
right.
It's a big area of conversation. And I think, you know, as people start to realize plastic is in their drinking water and they're being exposed to this, it's going to become a larger part of the conversation. And I think we can get through it, especially with something like bottled water, where we're not concerned about, you know, say, protecting the life in it. So hopefully we can get there.
You know, and you just mentioned nanoplastics. So if microplastics just are going to break down into smaller particles, then presumably the nanoplastics are even more everywhere. Is that a safe hypothesis?
That is the general thinking, yes. And so that has, to my knowledge, has not been confirmed, but that is generally the thinking. Obviously, yeah, as things continue to break down, they're just going to go to a smaller scale. How pervasive they're going to be, if they're going to move in similar ways, if they're going to be, you know, airborne as an example, I think really has, you know, yet to be determined. But the general idea is there are going to be a smaller version of microplastics. These are going to be nanoplastics. You know, as an example, in the human body, they potentially have the potential to be intercellular. You know, they could be that small. And so this is a part of the conversation that's starting now. They're going to be incredibly difficult to detect, to understand, you know, what they're doing in systems is going to be really a challenge. But again, I mean, we've seen so much innovation in this field, really led by some top quality researchers, that I think, you know, as long as these questions need to be answered, there'll be people working on them.
We only have about a minute left, but of course, the million-dollar question that your study did not try to make any claims about is possible health impacts of what we're talking about. Are you familiar with any research being done in that direction?
No. Oh, yeah. So this is the big question, right? And this is one of the areas we tried to be extremely cautious, because obviously the last thing we want to do is to cause a large-scale panic. So our goal with this study was to talk in terms of exposure, which is basically dose, right? So whenever you think about toxicology, one of the key concepts is dose. You know, you can think about this as something simple like alcohol. You know, how much are you exposed to? What does that mean? And so that was our first and primary goal, was to think about, okay, what is the best estimate we can give people for the dose that they're exposed to? And then can someone, or can we, extend that out to look at the impacts? So we now know that people are exposed to, you know, at minimum on the low end, 50,000, but heading up into the hundred thousands of microplastics a year. And so hopefully we can start that conversation. So the answer is, you know, we need to be very careful to make these statements. There's a lot of unknowns. So to date, there has not been any kind of concrete research that would show the effects of microplastics on people. Obviously, again, it hasn't been an area of study for too long, and it's also a really tough area to navigate something like scientific approval. So, but I will say that, you know, as a result of this study, I have been contacted by some researchers who think about things like nutritional impacts and food source impacts and things like this. And basically, exactly what I'd hoped would happen. They said, you know, hey, you've quantified dose.
I have to cut you off, Kieran, because we are out of time. But
thank you very much for having me on.
We will have you back on the show. Kieran Cox is a marine biology PhD candidate at the Anthakike Scholar at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Thanks very much for your time, Kieran. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you very much.
When we return, we're going to listen back to a conversation we had with Dr. Terry Root. She's a senior fellow emerita in the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University, about the ways plastics in the environment are hurting wildlife. I'm Mike Canary, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.